Mrs. May turned her head forward again, her expression unaltered. "I am the only adult on this place," she said. She leaned across the table and pulled the paper from the side of his plate. "Do you see how it's going to be when I die and you boys have to handle him?" she began. "Do you see why he didn't know whose bull that was? Because it was theirs. You see what I have to put up with? Do you see that if I hadn't kept my foot on his neck all these years, you boys might be milking cows every morning at 4 o'clock? Wesley pulled the paper back toward his plate and, staring at her full in the face, he murmured, "I wouldn't milk a cow to save your soul from hell." Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to From the Center, the podcast of the Center for Western Studies. I'm John Hodges here with the director of the center, and I'm with my good friend, Ben. Ben, welcome back. Glad to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. It's always good to see you. We have on the docket today to talk about one of my favorite authors and one of my favorite stories of my favorite authors.
Yes, we do.
Greenleaf by Flannery O'Connor. Now, I am a real Flannery fan. I think you maybe you're just getting used to her, huh? Have you read some of her before?
I'm right at the beginning.
Wonderful.
I've read a couple, and this is the first I've read for many years. So it was enjoyable.
Is that the right word?
No, that's the wrong word.
I'm not sure I ever used the word enjoyable. It is, but it's not the way you might think.
It was. Oh, well-crafted, and I'm glad I read it.
Good. And I'm glad you feel that way.
Digging it again, I think, after all.
I have taught this particular story many times, and I have I was recommended it early on. I don't know, probably 20 years ago, maybe. Somebody said, you need to read Flannery. So one summer, I started with A Good Man is Hard to Find.
Yep.
And I sat there after reading it. I just sat there in shock for a couple of minutes. And then I thought, I've got to read another one. And so I went on to another one and another one.
And
that summer, I just read the whole set of them. I've got the whole book here.
Yep.
I think you've got one there. The Complete Stories of Flannery O'Connor. And man, it was like pistachio nuts after a while or something, you know. You can't stop. You just have to read another one and another.
Yep.
And all of them are amazing. Many of them very shocking, like A Good Man is Hard to Find, like Greenleaf is kind of shocking, isn't it? So maybe what we ought to do is talk about the plot first, the plot and the characters, and see if we can't figure that out, because it's not always very clear. And then we can talk about what it all means, what she's trying to say about it.
Absolutely.
Sounded good? And the temptation, I think, for most of us is to try and figure out what's being said first, and a lot of times we miss some of the details. So it's good to talk about the plot. And many of our readers may not have even read the story, so it'd be good for us to walk through that.
If you're listening and you've got access to it, it'll take you 20 minutes to read. So grab a copy, read along, and then come back, and we'll be talking about it.
Maybe we even want to suggest that they pause the podcast and read it and then come back.
You're allowed to pause.
Yeah, very good. All right. So where do you start with the plot?
Opens with a bull under a window eating a hedge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then Mrs. May wakes up, if she was sleeping, and she's angry about it.
Right.
And then we kind of progress from there and we get to know Mrs. May.
Yeah, what do we get about Mrs. May? What kind of a person is she?
Mrs. May is not a pleasant person. Mrs. May is the tragic figure of her own life, who is put upon and working hard, and if it wasn't for her, goodness, everything would be going to pot.
It's because of her strength and her willpower and all the
hard work.
We heard a little of that in the quote, didn't we, in the beginning.
That's right.
Right. She's a widow. right? She's
a widow.
Lost her husband. She runs a dairy farm. She's got a herd of...
She owns a dairy farm. At no point in the story does she do anything that could be called work.
That's a good point. She has a handyman that helps her.
She has other people, yes.
That's right. That's right. She kind of wants her own sons to help her, but they don't seem that interested in helping, as you could see in that first bit. Have you ever heard anything more shocking to say to your mother than I wouldn't?
It was a great sentence to jump off the page.
Oh, man. Would milk a cow to save your soul from hell?
Yeah. Whew.
Well, okay. But she does have a handyman, this Mr. Greenleaf.
Yes. And so, and the story is called Greenleaf. So as soon as you hear about Mr. Greenleaf, you know that's kind of where the center of the story is going to be. So it's very interesting.
Right.
You meet Mr. Greenleaf. He's very southern. He takes his time.
Yes. Didn't hurry to anything.
He doesn't hurry to an opinion or, or a piece of work or anything. He's taking his time and is he enjoying himself or not? I'm not totally sure.
Hard to tell. What do we learn about him along the way?
He's got a wife. He's
got a wife.
Two sons and five daughters. He's been working for her for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Got a place on the property, and then his sons have set up nearby.
Right, right. Right, and what do we know about Mrs. May's sons?
Mrs. May has two boys,
right.
She says, children. But, of course, we find out they're in their 30s, not perhaps as childlike as she describes them. Wesley is an intellectual. Which means he teaches at the university.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And he didn't fight in the war because he wasn't physically fit enough.
Mm-hmm.
Schofield is the other son who sells insurance that she doesn't approve of because he sells it to Negroes.
That's
which
right.
is, for her, not an honorable profession.
Kind of beneath her.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he did fight in the war, but didn't do very well. And they both live with her and put up with her.
But they're in their 30s.
They're in their 30s.
Yeah. Very interesting. So she's got a dairy farm and a herd, and she's mad about this bull. This bull keeps getting into her garden or into her yard, whatever, and... chews up the hedges. Seems to be tearing up hedges.
Yeah, she's worried it's going to get into her cows.
Right, it could ruin her herd if he mates with her herd. Because she calls him a scrub bull.
Yes,
a scrub bull.
What does a scrub bull mean?
I don't know exactly what that is, but it doesn't sound good.
We don't have like quite a farming background.
I'm afraid that's outside of our parameters here. But obviously from the way she says it with such disdain, you know, he's an inferior bull. He's not good enough for her cows.
Very much not.
Right,
not of the right class.
So it is really similar to the way she looks at so many other people.
Everybody
in the book,
else.
Right? Everybody's not quite good enough, you know.
Yeah,
girls are not good enough for her boys either. But we find out
that's
that her
true.
Boys are not all that great. I don't know why she would think that, but that's how she thinks.
Yep.
And Mr. Greenleaf has a wife who has some odd proclivities.
Yes.
She seems to want to she cuts out articles from the newspaper about tragedies, people being wounded in car crashes or airplane wrecks or something like that. And she takes them out into the woods and digs a hole and puts them all in the hole and then prays over them.
Yes,
right?
Which we get to
weeping
have a little picture of.
Well, it seems like Mrs. May found her doing this once, and she's just, you know, covered in dirt.
She was aghast.
And she's, and yeah, right. Mrs. May is aghast at the picture, right?
Yep.
And she says, "What are you doing? You know, go back and take care of your family or something."
Jesus would be ashamed of you. He'd tell
Jesus
you to go back and clean up your kids.
Jesus would be ashamed of you. Yes. Because she's weeping over the... And it's interesting what she says, too. Do you remember her prayer?
Yes, stab me in the heart, Jesus.
Jesus, stab me in the heart.
She's trying to take on the pain of others in herself.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. An
aspect of her faith.
Turns out it's a somewhat biblical idea even, you know, that we are somehow able to. Paul says that mysterious line about how we are to make up for the lack of sufferings of Jesus or something like that. I've always wondered about that. How on earth could that be? But it looks like that's what she's doing, being very sort of an empath, kind of taking pain
she's trying to take it on.
Yeah. But Mrs. May is just disgusted with that.
Yes.
In fact, it kind of gives you a picture of what she thinks of the church or about Christianity, because at one point she tells her boys to go to church. Do you remember what she says?
I remember the section where Mrs. May is described as a good Christian.
Right.
Who obviously didn't believe a word of it, but thought that it was important that people go to church or something like that.
That's right. And in particular, she says to her boys, you ought to go to church. You could find some nice girls.
Oh, is that? Okay.
That's the reason for going.
It would be useful.
Yeah, right. So there you have the sort of setup. Now, the dynamic between Mrs. May and Mr. Greenleaf is kind of central to the story. We heard a little bit of that in the quote we did at the beginning, because she's saying to her boys, if I didn't, you know, keep my foot on his neck to work around here, then you boys would have to take up that slack. You ought to be thanking me, basically. They obviously respond. One of them responds with that horrible statement. So Mr. Greenleaf doesn't seem to be a willing worker, and not a fast worker, certainly, but maybe even not a willing worker. And he eventually describes why it is he feels that way.
Okay.
He says, you've got two healthy boys in there. They ought to be helping you. Mm-hmm. And that stings, because she knows it's true, but she can't make him do anything.
Yep.
So he has a bit of disdain for the boys, I think, you know. And she has nothing but disdain for his family, obviously, seeing Mrs. Greenleaf in such a, you know, position in the woods, weeping over the sufferings of others and praying. But she has a picture, too, of the two boys, of the Greenleaf boys.
E.T. and O.T.
Yes, E.T. and O.T.
Yeah.
We never do find out what they stand for, but they're just initials, E.T. and O.T. I think they're twins, too, aren't they? Are they twins? Maybe they're not twins. I'm not forget. Sure. But anyway, she has this picture of them that they have been handed everything all their lives. They had gotten government grants for their
She has this long thing about how the government have given them this and that. Their education, of course, they took that opportunity to go to university with their veteran status. Benefits.
Yeah. That's the piece that gets left out of her thinking, because
sure doesn't. Yeah,
they actually both fought in France and were wounded and had medals.
Well, they got themselves wounded.
They got themselves wounded
because they're trying to pull one over on all of the honest, hardworking people like herself.
Like herself, exactly.
Who's ending up paying for their stuff.
Yeah. Our listeners, I know, will be aware of the idea of an unreliable narrator.
Yes,
and
very
this,
much
I
so.
Think Flannery is great at doing that. Because I remember reading it for the first time and seeing, here's this woman who's a widow and she has to keep track of all this stuff and run this place, and her boys seem to be good for nothing. And I was very sympathetic with her for a while, you know. And then you begin to see cracks in her vision of things. Flannery slowly sort of opens your eyes to things, you know, about what's really going on. And by the three quarters of the way through, she goes to see OT and ET's place.
Yes, she does.
And it's spotless and it's beautiful.
Yeah. And she can't stay looking at it. She sneaks in to take a look to, in her words, see how filthy it is.
Because they're running a dairy farm,
They're running a dairy farm. Yeah, right. That's right. And it's absolutely pristine and spotless and neat. And she immediately runs out because she's confronted with this complete incongruence.
Exactly.
What she has, the narrative she's telling herself is absolutely false. And
that's
she,
where
and she doesn't stay around.
And she can't stand
she
it.
Can't stand
she
it.
Can't
she
can't yeah, look
she's horrified
at it.
By it.
And the way Flannery describes it, I'm going to see if I can't find that spot because I think it it's a brilliant bit of writing.
Why don't you read it to us?
She
decided that since no one was here, she would get out and have a look at the milking parlor and see if they kept it clean.
Mm.
She's obviously assuming that they don't.
Right.
She opened the milking room door and stuck her head in, and for the first second, she felt as if she were going to lose her breath. The spotless white concrete room was filled with sunlight that came from a row of windows, head high along both walls. The metal stanchions gleamed ferociously, and she had to squint to be able to look at all.
Huh.
She drew her head out of the room quickly and closed the door and leaned against it, frowning. The light outside was not so bright, but she was conscious that the sun was directly on top of her head, like a silver bullet ready to drop into her brain.
Isn't that something? The sun was directly on top of her head, the source of light itself, right, in this world. She had to squint to see inside this building, and she can't stand what she sees. And the light of the sun somehow is so oppressive that it's like a bullet dropping into her brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great picture of her, and one of the best moments where you get this idea that her narration so far has to be questioned.
Yeah,
that she's not really seeing things as they really are. Mm-hmm. Right, and as you said at the beginning, it starts off with her in her asleep at night, I guess, and she's dreaming. Something about a bull chewing its way through the hedges and then through the walls of the house and into the house and would just chew up the entire place, including her and her sons and everything.
Chew up everything that's hers.
That's right. If she let him, you know.
Yes.
And then she wakes up and she hears this munching going on out in the. Yep. I want to read that description too, because that's the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. And the way she describes the bull, I think, is important. And every time the bull gets described, he gets some of this treatment. let's see. Mrs. May's bedroom window was low and faced on the east, and the bull, silvered in the moonlight, stood under that window, under it, his head raised as if he listened, like some patient god come down to woo her.
Mm.
Listened for a stir inside the room. The window was dark and the sound of her breathing too light to be carried outside. Clouds crossing the moon blackened him, and in the dark he began to tear at the hedge. Presently, they passed, and he appeared again in the same spot, chewing steadily, with a hedge wreath that he had ripped loose for himself, caught in the tips of his horns. That's the picture. He's a like a god come to woo her, and he's got a crown of hedge in his...
A crown of hedge?
Hedge in his... In
whatever
his,
can this mean?
Yeah, exactly. So, and other places he's talked about in the same way, like a lover. Mm-hmm. At the end, I guess we should talk about the end.
Yes.
The problem for her in the play is, in the story, is that this bull keeps getting loose. And the bull turns out to belong to Mr. Greenleaf's family,
yep.
O.T. and E.T., I think. And no matter how many times they pin him up, He keeps breaking out. And when he breaks out, he seems to want to come to her house.
And then he's trying to get to her. Yep.
And one time he seems agitated by automobiles. And so one time he actually charged a car and banged his head into it, you know. So a little foreshadowing there. because what happens at the end, of course, is that she's sitting on the bumper of a car as he goes off, as she's insisted that Mr. Greenleaf go off and shoot this bull, kill him, get rid of him before he messes up her herds. And so he goes off into the woods to find this, reluctantly goes off in the woods to find this bull. And while he's gone, the bull shows up and charges the car. And Mrs. May, mm-hmm. is sitting on the bumper of the car, and the bull gores her and she dies.
And that's
and that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when he's described there, maybe we should read the description of him there. Have you got mm-hmm. that page?
I do.
What is it? How does it describe the bull coming at her?
She looked back and saw that the bull, his head lowered, was racing toward her. She remained perfectly still, not in fright, but in a freezing unbelief.
Unbelief.
She stared at the violent black streak bounding toward her as if she had no sense of distance, as if she could not decide at once what his intention was. And the bull had buried his head in her lap like a wild, tormented lover before her expression changed. One of his horns sank until it pierced her heart, and the other curved around her side and held her in an unbreakable grip.
It's right.
The language is all that of lovers.
Of lovers.
And courtship and these things.
Right, right. Buried his head in her lap like a frenzied, what was the word?
Tormented lover.
And then it says one last thing before the end of the story, doesn't it? It has one more little bit. You should read us that.
She continued to stare straight ahead, but the entire scene in front of her had changed. The tree line was a dark wound in a world that was nothing but sky, and she had the look of a person whose sight has been suddenly restored, but who finds the light unbearable.
There's an echo of that moment where she's in the dairy farm, O.T. and E.T.'s dairy farm. She finds the light unbearable. She can't actually look into it, like the sun dropping a bullet into her brain kind of thing. The light itself is unbearable. So here, I think, confirms that notion of an unreliable, you know, narrator.
Yes.
Because all the while, she's been believing the world was one way, and now she's being... it's being forced on her that it's not that mm-hmm. way, that it's something else.
Yeah.
And it's forced on her by death. It's forced on her by a bull. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about what it all means
okay.
then. What is this? What is she talking about? Why would she write such a shocking ending to a fairly, you know, unlikable person? Why would she tell this story?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it's a strange mix of, it's the ending that you thought would be satisfying, as she's, you know, chasing around, as she's ordering, Mr. Greenleaf to go chase the bull and shoot her. I'm thinking as a reader, you know, boy, I hope she gets what she deserves and doesn't get to go on controlling everyone around her.
Right.
But when it comes, it's obviously quite unsatisfying.
Yes.
Because is it a catharsis? Is anyone better off?
Yeah. Is this some kind of justice then for a person who's such a miserable?
It's not redemption, clearly.
Yeah.
So what is it?
Or is it redemption of a sense?
Okay.
In a sense. If we think of the bull in the way that she describes him.
The bull seems to be divine.
Uh-huh.
It's uncontrollable.
He's like a god. He's uncontrollable. Can't keep him.
Io is strongly kind of referenced in there.
Right, right.
Obviously, Christ is referenced. Nobody knows. Nobody's sure where the bull has come from. Nobody
right.
knows where the bull is. Nobody
right.
can. They pen the bull up.
They can't,
and they can't
pen him up.
They can't contain him.
Right, right.
He doesn't do what they want. He doesn't go where they would have him.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
he's remarkably peaceful and unconcerned.
Yes. Doesn't seem violent.
Not necessarily violent.
No, he doesn't at all. He's not angry, is what I meant to say.
No, he's yes.
Yeah, yeah. He seems like a. He just doesn't happen to like that car or something. He doesn't like cars for some reason.
Or maybe he does like the car. Maybe he likes it too much.
but the wonderful descriptions are all do associate him with the divine, I think.
Yeah.
A god and a lover, of, you know, the bridegroom coming to claim his bride kind of attitude, which is a strange way to look
and
at a bull.
Coming to her at night.
Coming to her at her night. Window, exactly. Like Romeo at the balcony kind of thing, you know. And you can't get around the fact that he's got this wreath in his hair, in his horns, rather.
Yep.
Not unlike a crown of thorns, yeah. You know. That's what's obvious there, I think. So if that's the case, then and he plays the role of a divine figure that's unstoppable.
Yes.
And she's afraid of him munching through her house. You know, she dreams of him eating everything up.
Yeah,
destroying her herds, that kind of thing, and she has to oppose him. Then it's not too far, I think, to say that she is an unrepentant person, a person who's in need of salvation, and God is pursuing her.
Okay,
like the lover, you know. And so, if that's the case, then. I remember teaching this to a bunch of college students one time, and had some really sharp folks. And I gave them that interpretation that the bull is actually the Christ figure in this.
Yep.
And they were horrified. They said, "Oh no, that can't be right." And then one of them said, "Well, but why did they shoot the bull at the end? Because that's the part we didn't read, I guess. Because they had to shoot the bull.
He shot the bull four times through the eye.
Yeah." So he does die. And I said, well, didn't Christ have to die? And they said, well, wait a minute. Wait, okay, but she didn't have to die. And I said, didn't she? I mean, don't we die to ourselves and live in Christ? You know, we have to be born again. We have to die and take up our cross daily and all that kind of thing, you see? So maybe this really is that picture.
Okay.
And the only redemption, the only thing, because Flannery is famous for giving you a flash in the pan of redemption, and it's gone, right?
No, well, I see.
You see where it's coming?
That's right.
So what would you say is the redemption then at the end? There's only a little flash.
It's tiny. So Mr. Greenleaf comes. She saw him approaching on the outside of some invisible circle. He shot the bull four times through the eye. She did not hear the shots, but she felt the quake in the huge body as it sank, pulling her forward on its head, mm-hmm. so that she seemed, when Mr. Greenleaf reached her, to be bent over, whispering some last discovery into the animal's ear.
That's the end. There you have it. Some last, what? Discovery. She's finally able to see.
Has she finally accepted?
Yeah. Something? Well, that's a question, right? Whether she's accepting that or not. Yeah. But it's a discovery of the truth, at least. And it seems like she's whispering that into his ear, which...
Who knows?
Confession?
We don't know. Yes.
I mean, doesn't confess? We confess our sins, you know, and we're redeemed. So anyway, I think that's what she's doing. And everything in this story then kind of flips around, because Mrs. Greenleaf seemed like such a bizarre, you know, charismatic maybe character doing some weird snake handling or something, right?
Yes.
But it turns out she really is she cares about being empathetic with the sufferings of the world like Christ.
Yeah.
OT and ET are not the scruffy little people. They're the war heroes that have been wounded in France in the war and come back and now are doing excellent work, and married French women.
They did. They're bilingual children. That's right.
And when she goes to see them, you know, they may be a little scruffy looking, but they speak to each other in French, and then they speak to her in English. And,
They're respectful, but they also don't put up with her.
Right.
Nonsense.
Right.
They won't be ordered around.
So the world that as she saw it is not the world as it really is. And
yes,
I think this is a story about how she gets a moment of a flash of inspiration or discovery at the very last second in her life.
Okay.
Which is not unlike the story of A Good Man Is Hard to Find, if you remember. That's when this grandmother is shot by this criminal. And she's been a mess the whole time, the whole story, and she comes to the end of her life, and this criminal shoots her, and the criminal says to his buddies, she'd have been a good woman if she'd had somebody around to shoot her every day of her life. Isn't that a great idea?
That's a great line.
And that's what it is. If you face death, suddenly everything becomes pretty clear, you know, the yes. important things stand out and the unimportant things disappear. Yeah. You find you'd be spending your life doing all sorts of unimportant things, you know, that's what she realized at the very last second. She realizes this and then she dies.
Okay.
So it's very similar in this case, I think, to Greenleaf. So that's the story. That's the story. I hope everybody got a chance to read it before you heard about the interpretation. And if you have a different interpretation, we'd like to hear about it. So give us a call. Write us a note. Let us know what you think. And we'll be glad to talk to you about that if you get it to us. I'm at director@centerws.com as an email. Send me that. And we will take a look at it. And next week, maybe we could talk about another one.
That would be lovely.
How would that be?
Yeah, I'd love to dig further into these stories.
Yeah, yeah. And in the future, we'll be looking at other stories and other authors. And if you've got some suggestions for us, it's books that you'd like us to talk about, let us know. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Joe.